Hello, you're listening to the Industry Leaders Podcast. I'm Sarah Goldboyle, and on the show with me today is Hector Hughes. Now, Hector is the co-founder of Unplugged, the business that is on a mission to help people escape their phones and go off-grid. I'll let Hector explain exactly what that means, although you probably know already because their getaway cabins are nearly always booked out. But before we get to that, Hector, it's great to chat with you. How are you?
Yeah, so good to be here. I'm very well, thank you, and very excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, I'm delighted to have you because I think your business is unusual, it's different. So I wonder, could you tell us, for anyone who doesn't know, what exactly is Unplugged?
For sure. So very simply, we do digital detoxes at off-grid cabins in the countryside. So we currently have 20 cabins across the UK. And what basically happens when you arrive at one of our cabins, it's always 3 nights. And you, upon arrival, padlock your phone in a box. We give you a map and a Nokia and leave you to it. And that's all there is to it.
Fantastic. And can you tell me, where did the idea come from?
So it came from, I guess, my own experience burning out and used to work with Ben, my now co-founder. We were early employees at a tech startup. So it was iPad till systems, very different. And we did the whole high growth, international expansion, opened up in the US and Australia. And then 2019 just started to, I think, lose my, I would say, joy for life and just really kind of feel a dissatisfaction with it all. And this led to a silent retreat in the Himalayas in September 2019, which was at this Buddhist temple on top of a mountain. And when that first got suggested, I laughed it off. I said, I can't do that. But got myself out there and it was incredible. It was this beautiful Buddhist temple. And the best thing about it is when you get there, they take your phone off you and you just spend 10 days cut off from the outside world. So very cliche, but I came back from that, quit my job a week later, and that was off the back of a conversation with Ben. He'd left the startup at that point, but we'd stayed friends. He's not the kind of guy you'd find at a silent retreat anytime soon. And we spoke about how there's a lot of stigma around retreats and meditation, and so much of the benefit is just getting people offline and into nature. And there wasn't really any accessible solutions to do that. You know, everything was quite high friction. Obviously, some people were going off and camping in the Lake District, but a lot of people just weren't getting out of the city and crucially offline. So we really wanted to make something that filled that gap.
Oh, fantastic. And I mean, can you tell us about the retreat? Because that's just, you know, fascinating. Did you find it difficult? Did you find you missed your phone? Did you find, like, I'd say some people feel like they have their right hand cut off. They don't have their phone.
For sure, for sure. So the retreat, it was a real roller coaster. Like, you go through all of the emotions. I, for whatever reason, was very ready at that point in my life for just some time offline, you know, being like a hectic few months to get me there. And so by the time I got there, I was just like, take my phone off me. So the getting off the phone and the silence were actually a real blessing and a gift. So I really didn't find that tricky at all and found a lot of joy in that, especially the silence, actually. Like, whenever I speak to people about silent retreats, they're always like, oh God, I don't know if I could be silent for 10 days. But then most people you meet who have done them are like, actually, that was almost the nicest thing about it. It just takes a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of the pressure off, you know, like we're talking all day and actually it's quite nice to just not need to for 10 days. So that was a real joy. The retreat I did was called Intro to Buddhism. So it was basically half Buddhist philosophy and half meditation. I was not religious going into it. I still don't describe myself as religious, but it was a real eye-opener. I think I was very like arrogant and naive about what role religion played in society up until that. And then it really opened my eyes to like, actually, religion is really just a kind of guide to living a good life. And obviously that goes wrong in certain cases throughout history. Like, religion has caused many issues. But I think the Buddhists have a very nice way of looking at the world. And there's a lot of wisdom in there. So I really enjoyed that part of it as well. And then, you know, if you're meditating for 4 or 5 hours a day, it's hard not to come out of that feeling good.
Mm, yeah, for sure. And essentially what you do is you take people's phones off them when you go into the cabin. You give them a Nokia, you give them a map, and you just leave them to it. So do people go on walks? What actually do people end up doing?
Yeah, well, we were really worried about this before launching. We were like, oh my God, people are going to get bored. Like, we've got to put on all these activities. But the time really goes pretty fast. And the key is just to get people off their phones. What we don't realize is basically you pick your phone up first thing in the morning and then we're just checking it all day until we get to bed, basically. And what that does is it just means we're in this constant state of overstimulation. And the challenge is that we've now completely normalized that. So it's normal to feel overstimulated and that causes us to be anxious, stressed. And it's only when you take that away. So it takes about a day for the mind to settle down. And as you said, for the first 24 hours, like, you are a bit more anxious because you do feel like you've lost a limb. And then the mind just starts to settle down and you access this deep sense of calm. Really what we are doing is helping people get to that place. because, you know, we're not about changing your habits in 3 days. We're about changing your perspective and seeing, you know, what's possible with a few days offline. Because again, tech's great. It's here to stay. It's the future. And, you know, we're only going to spend more time online. But that just highlights the importance and the benefit of spending time offline. So what do people do? They read, they walk, you know, they talk, if they're a couple, cook. It's really just about those simple things done well that maybe, you know, we don't do so much of, because I think so much of, you know, happiness and calm and kind of resetting is about taking away. We always feel like we need to add more. But actually, if you just take away a few of the things that are causing the stress and the anxiety, then magical things can happen.
For sure. And can you tell me a little bit about the 3-day effect?
Yeah, for sure. So the 3-day effect, scientific study that found that you need about 3 days in nature to properly reset. So again, as I mentioned, with 24 hours to take the mind to settle down, it's so kind of deeply ingrained in us, the stress and just kind of accumulated stimulation of living in the city, actually getting out into nature, which is where, you know, we were for thousands of years and where we're from. And it just has this amazing calming effect on our body. And so what they found is that 72 hours is what you need to properly reset. That's not to say that, you know, going for a walk in a park or just getting any exposure to nature isn't going to give huge benefits, but it's like, just give yourself 72 hours that we can all take that out of our day.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sure we'll come back to kind of the benefits and so on. But to take us away from the lovely, restful, mindful conversation, I think your growth story is also really, really impressive and really interesting. I suppose you kind of came around at an odd time. You were kind of early 2020, I think, when you found it, which was possibly not ideal. But maybe it was. I don't know. You can tell me. But what do you think you got right in the early days that got you off to a good start?
It's a great question. We learned a lot of lessons from our previous startup. I think came into it with a lot of things that we got wrong previously that we've kind of corrected for. Not to say we've got everything right. We've got lots of things wrong as well. But some of the things we've got right, I think, is really getting the people part right. So, you know, a company is just a group of people, and who those people are is everything. So I think being really careful about who we hire and how we hire has been huge. So again, we're not a big team with 11 people now. But getting that right and really focusing on culture, I think creating a culture of psychological safety is super important. Like previously, have seen when things go wrong at previous companies and you lose that psychological safety, and it becomes about, you know, who's right rather than what's right. And I think that's a toxic place to be, because you then end up burying mistakes, like people feel safe to share failures, etc. So I think at the start, as a founder, you're doing everything, but that doesn't scale. And so you've got to do it at the start, but then it's all about building the team of people who come and do it. And the other thing I think is just focusing on, you know, ironically, given the business we're in, but you need to make it sexy in this day and age and kind of days of social media and frankly, the virality you can achieve through that. And I was running growth at the previous company, didn't do a very good job of it, wasn't great at my role. But one of the insights there, apart from not being good at it myself, was that we just didn't have anything particularly unique. We were trying to be everything to everyone. And that wasn't a product that did a good job of selling itself. So I think you can build a lot of that into, you know, how you design a product. And you know, the simpler it is, the more tangible it is for people. But also sexy, you know, the good thing about cabins is they do have this kind of sex appeal, for lack of a better phrase.
Yeah, they do. And why do you think the product resonates with customers? Why is it so powerful?
It's a great question. I think it's tapping into a subconscious feeling that almost hasn't become common knowledge yet, that we all feel anxiety and stress to our devices. And we're perhaps not aware of it because we just go through our days in this state of overstimulation and we're mindless, effectively. We're not really kind of present with what's going on. So I think when people come across what we do, it evokes a strong reaction. And that can be either way. You know, some people are like, there is no way I'm doing this. I can never spend 3 days on my phone. But other people are like, this is exactly what I need. So again, no genius by us. We just stumbled onto a solution that actually works really well and is simple, right? Like just go and spend 3 nights in a cabin off your phone, by yourself, with a partner, whatever it is. So I think that has really helped make it tangible for people. Like a lot of solutions out there today, especially in the, let's call it the wellness space, are a little too complicated. And even the word wellness, I think, is a bit tricky and maybe brings up the wrong ideas with people. So I think it's just about simple, you know, you are stressed out by your phone, come and spend 3 days without it in a cabin.
Yeah, I think you're underselling yourself a little bit in terms of you're doing it. I think you're being smart about it. When I go and I look at the website, I go, oh God, yeah, I'd love to do that.
Yeah.
It's not something that's just happened organically.
Like I said about the team, there's a lot of much smarter people than me kind of doing a lot of great things on that side of things for us now. So I can't take any credit for that. But at the core is a simple idea.
Yeah. Yeah. And can you tell me a little bit about the people that you have? Because I always find startups really interesting, you know, in terms of how you went about picking people and how you go about handing over ownership or control of something onto somebody new.
For sure. Great question. So first, on the hiring side, I think maybe one slightly unconventional thing we look for is actually, instead of looking for the brand names, we actually go for people who are off the back of failures. I think definitely have a tendency towards that. So rather than hiring people, you know, fresh off a few years at Revolut, hire the people who have just come off the back of a failure. And a few reasons for that. One is, I think Ben and I basically came from that world as well. So our startup kind of imploded towards the end. They actually went on to be successful in the end, but our chapter ended in failure. And it's when things go wrong that you really kind of see the nature of what's happening. You know, when things go right, you've got a narrower view of like, this thing really worked, but you maybe don't have such a great sense of the whole. So I think it's, you know, by seeing what can go wrong, gives you a real understanding of what's happening. And then also, fundamentally, people are just undervalued off the back of a failure. Like, if you've worked for Google, you're going to command a very high salary. Maybe you deserve it, but it's almost like that badge name. You know, people who say whose LinkedIn bio is ex McKinsey, great. But, you know, in my mind as an employer, it biases me, right? Like, I think, oh my gosh, this person must be great. And when they say anything, it's like, wow, you know, well, there it's McKinsey. But actually, the person off the back of a failure, like, hasn't got any of that. And, you know, you still want to pay them well and fairly, but you don't have to overpay them because they went to work for this company. And the last one, I think, is just people have something to prove. You know, we have something to prove coming into this because we don't have much to show from the last one, apart from some great learnings and some great connections, and, you know, want to go out and like actually make it work this time. So I think it's, you know, when you get kicked by life and you fail, that you really want to come back stronger. So that's a bit about how we've thought about hiring. And then the other thing is just hire for character. So hire like nice people, hire people with intellectual humility. Again, it's not about being right. It's about what's right, you know, and just really focusing on those kind of people. And I think if you bring the right people in, then it creates that culture, right? Like, who you add to the culture creates the culture. And then in terms of the delegating, trusting, for my numerous flaws, I think one strength I have is I have a very easy time trusting people. So I'm actually much better at the delegating than I am at doing the work. So I was always hopeless at the various jobs I had to do back in the day. But delegating, fundamentally, you know, you are trusting that person. I think that is like the people who have a hard time delegating are people who have, you know, very details oriented, have a very kind of high quality bar themselves. I'll be honest, I'm really not a details guy, fairly dyslexic. I have a high bar for myself, but not for others. And so, you know, obviously want to have a high bar for the company. And so actually I just choose to surround myself with people who have that high bar. And fundamentally, again, like, I'm not going to blame someone because they didn't do it right. It's like, well, why didn't they do it right? And what could I have done better? And how can I support them in this? So I think it's really about that. It's really about reframing your role as, hey, my role here is to support them to do their job. Like, not questioning, are they the right person? Like, blah, blah, blah. It's like, you've got to trust them until they give you a reason not to. Like, if someone really doesn't work out and they steal from the company or whatever it might be, then of course you've got to take a decision. But, you know, you've hired this person, you brought them onto the team, you've got to back them, you've got to trust them, and you've got to be all in. And I think when people start to, you know, resentment slips in and people kind of project their insecurities or their frustrations, then that's when, you know, relationships can get toxic and people pick up on that, you know, like, people reciprocate. If you're not going to trust someone, then they're not going to trust you back. So I think if you can just be as trusting and open as possible, then that comes back.
Mm. And that fits in with something you've written about approaching people with unconditional compassion as well. I just really like the phrase unconditional compassion. It kind of struck a chord with me. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
Yeah, for sure. Again, I think compassion is a bit of almost a dirty word where it kind of sounds very woo-woo. And so I think we almost discredit it. But compassion to me is just a kind of complete just love and respect for whoever you're dealing with. And I think what it does is it just takes you out of yourself, because all of our problems are ego problems. You know, it's when our ego comes up and it says, I'm annoyed that this thing happened because, you know, this person's let me down or whatever it is. And I think if you're operating from that place of compassion, which is hard to do all the time, you know, it's not binary, like, you can act with more and more compassion and work on that, then it just takes you out of your own head. I think it's pretty amazing that the people we have in our team are people who are like helping me, and I'm just a small cog in the machine, but helping me do this thing. Like, we're working together to make this change in the world. And that's pretty amazing. And so, like, I want to kind of have a loving and supportive attitude with all those people. And again, it is reciprocated. Like, the kinder you show up to the world, the kinder the world's going to be to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And I wonder, could you tell me about something that may be difficult or surprising that's happened at Unplugged? It could be something that surprised you about how customers respond to a certain venture or a certain idea. Can you tell me about a situation like that and maybe how it's changed how you approach the business?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, not on the customer side, but I guess talking about the company side, we fundamentally have chosen a very capital intensive business. We own and operate our own cabins. Cabins are expensive. And I think I went into it with a real just arrogance. I was like, we're not going to build our business for investors. You know, like, we're going to focus on building our business, and, you know, investors can kind of join if they want. And that's great. And, you know, obviously it needs to be about the customer and the change you're making in the world. But you do also need to consider that side of things if you do need the money. So you need to also build a business that is attractive for people to invest in and that works. So it took me a long time to just figure out how to sort that out, and basically how to structure that so that it is attractive to people, because we just kind of sat in this weird space without going too into the weeds of it, where we're not really a VC play. It's not really a kind of interesting to institutional debt. So there was a lot of kind of figuring that one out. So maybe that's not exactly the answer you were looking for, but that was a big learning from my side of just like really understanding what the game you're playing is. And you're playing lots of games all the time. It's just like my role as a founder and CEO, like, a lot of it is also just kind of getting the resources to make sure we can deliver on this mission. And that's the people, which we've already spoken about, but it's also the capital. And I just have to figure that out. Like, it's got there, but it's taken time, and you just have to find a way. And if it's you're doing the wrong thing, then you need to change course and figure out a way to do it. So I've done lots of iterating on the back end that people don't see about just how we finance these things, how we work as a business to make sure that we can do the same end product, which is getting people offline and into nature. So that's been a challenge, something that surprised me, and big learning curve for sure.
Mm. Yeah, and that can be a lot of the invisible work that has to get done, but it can be sometimes, yeah. So tell me, looking kind of forwards now, where do you want to bring it? How many people are you going to get off on digital detoxes?
Well, I think the future's much more malleable than we think. Like, we think it's this very deterministic thing of it was always going to be that way, and that's not the case. And actually, we do all have the power to move it in a different direction. And I think what this is a really interesting social experiment. You know, if we can get to the stage where we normalize digital detox, and we can get hundreds of thousands or millions of people spending a few nights offline in the cabin a few times a year, then that will create some profound changes to society. And I don't know what they are, but really excited to find out.
Mm, for sure. I would imagine that the idea resonates quite a lot with artists and writers. Would I be right?
For sure. Yeah. We have a lot of creatives going. So people writing books. We always get tagged in pictures of people who have painted the cabin or sketched the cabin, that kind of thing, which is always nice. Couples are the other, I think, big surprise, actually, where we saw this as, when we were conceiving it, very much kind of solitary retreat, and that would probably be the predominant customer base. But actually, it is probably 80% couples. And, you know, we get a lot of feedback that this is the first time, you know, in our 8-year relationship that we've actually spent a day offline together, which is amazing to see. And we've probably had 20 engagements to date that we know about. Yeah, there's some really cool stories like that. So I think that's been a really interesting surprise as well.
Mm-hmm. And have customers come back to you with any kind of surprising observations or things that have arisen from a stay in your cabin?
Yes, it's hard to say, because nothing's too surprising by now, because, you know, we've had it all. Like, in the early days, we were meeting everyone. So Ben and I were actually cleaning the cabin. We'd check people in, check them out. And one of the really surprising things was, you look at someone, like, bear in mind, they're only in there for 3 nights. Like, we would see people on a Thursday, see them again on a Sunday, and they would look 10 years younger. Like, it's a remarkable thing, just because you have all this pent up stress and, you know, you're holding that in your face. So I think that was a really big surprise. And one of the big things we hear over and over again is, like, people just realize that the world doesn't end if you spend 3 nights offline. I think we all have this narrative that we are too important to go and do something like this, and we just couldn't possibly. And I think it's when you've got that narrative in your head that you probably need it the most. You know, I still obviously run this business, try and do this as much as possible, like probably every 3 months or so. And every time I still think to myself, oh God, you know, can I justify it right now? Like, so busy. And then after a day or two of flying, I just think, obviously, like in hindsight, it's so obvious that that was the right thing to do. But the narrative persists.
Mm. And if you were to talk to somebody who's, say, starting off their own business, whether it's something totally different to Unplugged or, you know, anything in general, what kind of advice would you give to them?
First of all, I think the first step's the hardest one. So just get started, like get in motion, you know, things in motion, stay in motion. And there's a million reasons not to start something, right? And 99.9% of businesses fail right there before they even get started. So just get started, like whatever that looks like. And another great phrase I heard was, don't compare your chapter one to someone else's chapter 11. Because I think you just see, you know, endless examples of people who are further ahead and have figured it all out and it looks so easy. You know, like people can hear someone like me preaching on a podcast, and we're only 3.5 years in, so it's fairly early on our journey. And like what you don't see is everything they went through and just all the things they did wrong. And also just what's special about you, you know? Someone could hear me talking about some of the things that I consider my strengths today. But what they don't see is all my weaknesses and things that they do that are so much better than I could ever do. And the last bit of advice, I guess, would be just lean into what makes you unique, because I think there's no right answer for how to run a company. And find out what your superpowers are, like what really gives you energy, because managing your energy and your psychology is what's going to make this work. Like the biggest risk to any startup is the founder's psychology. It's that you burn out, you kind of lose your head when things get stressful, and you stop trying, and you quit, and you stop learning. So I think if you can get that piece right and do something that really excites you, energizes you, and fundamentally sets you up to kind of give this a proper run, then that's going to put you ahead of a lot of the things going on.
Yeah, for sure. And like I said earlier, you do write about this kind of thing quite a lot. So if anyone wants to find more of your writing, where can they go?
Yeah, for sure. Thank you for the plug. But I write a weekly newsletter at unplugging.substack.com, which I get a lot of joy out of. A lot of that's intrinsic as well. I think it's a really nice, always feels like a chore, but then actually sitting down and just really kind of expanding on an idea is quite a rare thing in this day and age. I've got a lot of joy out of that. Would love to see anyone on there, and always reply if anyone does message me on there.
Lovely. Okay, so if anyone would like to message, there you go right ahead. And just before we wrap up, can you tell me which is your favorite cabin that you've got?
Good question. Well, I can possibly say that. I went up a couple of weeks ago to see our latest cabin in the north of Wales, which is called Marley, and that is a beautiful spot. It's a 3,000 acre estate in a Welsh valley up in the hills, and yeah, really, really beautiful. So I haven't stayed there yet, but I'll give Marley a shout out. It's the current top of mind.
Okay, brilliant. Well, listen, Hector, I mean, I would love to come and stay in one. It sounds absolutely gorgeous. But listen, thank you so much for coming onto the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Such a pleasure to chat. Thank you so much for having me, and really appreciate it.
Okay, take care. That was Hector Hughes, co-founder of Unplugged. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Industry Leaders Podcast. And don't forget that you can catch up on all of our previous episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.